Good morning. The next matter on for oral argument this morning is State of Minnesota versus Alseums. Council, you'll each have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Please be mindful of those timing restrictions. They are indicated in the clock and light in the lectern, which you can raise or lower to your convenience for your height. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, because we keep only a public audio recording of the proceedings, and that way the listeners in the future can attach you to your arguments. With that, counsel for appellant, whenever you are ready to proceed, you may do so.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Robert Ambrose, A-M-B-R-O-S-E, here with co-counsel Benjamin Cole. We represent the appellant, Mr. Carl Alseums. A simple reversal for this court is in count 16 in the amended complaint, filing a false income tax return for 2016. There was insufficient evidence that Mr. Alseums filed a false 2016 income tax return. At trial, the prosecution quickly went through the 2016 tax year and merely elicited testimony from the Minnesota Department of Revenue for 2016 about disallowing Mr. Alseums' net operating loss for that year. No rental contracts were admitted by the prosecution into evidence for that year. The Minnesota Department of Revenue's testimony was that Mr. Alseums did not accurately reflect the net operating loss in the proper year and account it for every year thereafter. The two main disputed elements for this offense were, one, was the tax return false about a material matter, and two, did Mr. Alseums know it was false or fraudulent about a material matter when he filed the return? A mere disagreement about tax numbers does not mean the return is false, nor does it mean Mr. Alseums knew the return was false when he filed the return. To an extent, every income tax year in this case was a disagreement on numbers. In State versus Campbell, this court noted amounts alone cannot establish that someone has a legal duty to pay taxes on the funds as income. In Campbell, the court reversed a failure to pay taxes because of insufficient evidence to find Campbell willfully failed to pay those taxes. In that case, the state provided no circumstances that Campbell knew he had a legal duty to pay taxes on unreported funds and that he voluntarily and intentionally failed to do so. Here, the prosecution did not present sufficient evidence that Mr. Alseums knew his 2016 tax return was false, or for any other year for that matter. Additionally, they didn't provide sufficient evidence that he knew he had to pay sales tax for the 8 counts in the complaint.
Why wasn't the evidence sufficient for the inference of knowledge?
So I think we go to the Campbell case to say amounts alone can't establish that. To just say these numbers are wrong on the tax return, that's just not sufficient enough. I think for that prong, we're looking at the circumstantial evidence standard. And a reasonable inference is that Mr. Alseums thought his tax return was correct. He had a loss. He thought he could use it. He self-prepared these tax returns, and he noted on his 2016 return that he paid a judgment in a lawsuit of $550,000 plus interest and fees. He noted the Washington County court case number, and we submitted exhibits 200 and 201 during trial on where that loss came from. The Minnesota Department of Revenue did not claim that Mr. Alseums failed to have a loss. They just said they didn't allow him to have one. Merely saying they disallowed the net operating loss is insufficient evidence to convict him for 2016. I think that's an easy reversal for this court.
No, go ahead.
I was wondering about the net operating or the carryover loss in 2016, which is what that's about, right? The alleged fraud or false statements.
Yes, Your Honor.
In 2016, it was a 2013 judgment. What does the record, if anything, show about 2013, 2014, 2015, 2017, 2018? With respect to that loss.
So Mr. Alseums also noted it in 2013. He noted it in two tax returns, 2013 and 2016, if I'm not mistaken. What the Minnesota Department of Revenue said is that he didn't properly account for it in every year thereafter. So they disallowed it.
I mean, when was it paid? I guess I just don't know what the evidence says and when you can carry over. If it was paid in 2013 and then you keep carrying over that loss in whole every year thereafter?
I'd have to check about that.
How often can you carry over the same loss again and again?
I'd have to check the record on the exact year it was paid. I know it's in Exhibits 200 and 201. 201 has a satisfaction of judgment that was submitted to the court. My understanding of the IRS laws on the net operating loss is that you can account for the net operating loss in the year the loss happened, 2 years prior, and also 20 years forward from the year you had the loss. So what the Minnesota Department was basically saying is that you didn't properly account for it every year. And here we just had the disagreement. It wasn't that he knew it was false about a material matter. He thought and he testified that he could use this loss that he had.
So the whole loss can be carried over for all of those years, the full loss?
So my understanding of the law is...
To reduce your income.
To reduce your income. And if you have a year where you want to use it, you need to reduce your income, or you reduce your what is liable, and then you can carry it forward to the next year, and the next year and the next year until it's completely used up.
So, counsel, if I could ask you about the record on that. Does it show that you can reduce your income on your tax return, but that doesn't mean you can underreport your income, does it?
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Correct.
And isn't that exactly the testimony from the state's witness?
It is for some years, but if we look specifically at 2016.
Most of the 4 years, right? Underreporting portions of the income as well as specifically rental income in a number of years, right?
Right. But right. 2014 was about a property sale. 2015 was about a property sale.
Well, when you say about, that's one of the reasons given by the witness for the state. It's not the only reason, is it, in 2014?
There are some other minor things, consignments, some other business income. We're talking about the larger picture items here. And this case was a lot about rental income, and that dealt with years 2018 and 2019 primarily in the Neal Avenue property. The tax charges...
When you say 2018 and 19 is rental income, 2018 and 2019 has to do primarily with the failure to remit sales tax, doesn't it? There's still under reporting of rental income for the years prior to 2018, right?
For the...
I mean, again, this is according... I'm viewing the evidence in the light favorable to the jury's verdict, which I think this court is required to do.
Understood.
Okay.
Sales tax covered 2018, 2019, and especially the convictions in this case, the 8 sales tax charges. Mm-hmm. The income tax was 2014, 2015, 2016, and 2018 for convictions. Now, in this case, the charges should have been severed. The tax charges should have been their own separate trial. The security deposit theft by swindle should have been its own separate trial. Nothing about the 2014, 2015, or 2016 tax returns were related to theft by swindle.
When you say nothing is related to the theft by swindle, why don't you characterize for me what you think the state's case was on theft by swindle? Because I thought it had to do with, again, the rental, the use of this property for rental. It's different in the sense that it's not sales taxed, failure to remit sales tax. It has to do specifically with the appellant's relationship with the renters and the failure to return security deposits, right? So how is that unrelated? Help me out there.
Theft by swindle, 2 charges, 2018 and 2019, based on security deposits paid by renters that they didn't get back. 2014, 2015, and 2016 income tax years had nothing to do with the Neal Avenue property where he was renting. Nothing at all.
So 2014 and 2016, nothing about the Neal Avenue property.
2014, 2015,
but there is some
and
evidence about underreporting of rental income, right?
Not that I know of for 2014, 2015, maybe some 2016, but he wasn't renting out the Neal Avenue property to these renters that are the basis for the security deposit theft by swindle charges in 2018 and 2019. The analysis starts on severance whether offenses are part of a single behavioral incident. The income tax returns for 2014, 2015, and 2016 certainly were not related to security deposits in 2018 and 2019. We also need to look at whether it's the same time and place. Certainly, they were not the same time and place. In State versus Profit, the presence of multiple victims and a long span of time in between offenses can lead to reversal for improper joinder. The court in that case said joinder is improper where crimes are committed against separate victims at separate times with months in between. Here we have years in between. 2014, 2015, 2016 income tax and security deposits for theft by swindle in 2018 and 2019. Respondent argued in its brief, the geography of the charges were identical, the Neal Avenue property. That's false. The years 14, 15, and 16 were not about Neal Rentals because those security deposits were in 2018 and 2019. You can just look at the sufficiency of the evidence argument in their brief on page 38 that focused on other things besides rentals at Neal Avenue, like property sales at Inspiration and Orwell, which were the main focuses of 2014 and 2015 income tax. Respondent relies on the non-precedential Edwards case.
So, counsel, if I could ask you about another aspect to the severance issue, which is to examine whether there's prejudice to the appellant. One of the points that the district court made is that, you know, the under Rule 404B, this evidence would be admissible to not, of course, to prove conformity. So say the trials had been severed, that it wouldn't be admissible to prove conformity, but it could be used to prove absence of mistake. And, of course, mistake is one of the primary defenses that the appellant raised below. So would you comment on the district court's analysis there?
I think it would depend on which case would be tried first. If we're saying we have one trial completely on theft by swindle and one trial completely on the sales tax charges, then I think it would depend on whether he was convicted in the first trial or not. I think there is incredible prejudice towards Mr. Allseams to have all these charges tried together. I think part of the strategy from the prosecution was, let's get seven of these renters to come up here and testify about how they didn't get their security deposit back. Therefore, Mr. Allseams is a bad guy. Therefore, he must have cheated on his taxes. That's where the prejudice was. Now, the concern from courts often in severance is they don't want to have duplicative trials. Here, that wouldn't be the case. If you had one trial on just the tax, who testifies is the Minnesota Department of Revenue. What evidence is presented? The income tax stuff and the sales tax stuff. You have a second trial, just on theft by swindle. Who testifies? Just the renters. What evidence is presented? Not returning the deposits, the conciliation court matters. That's not time consuming. It probably equals the same length of time. We did this trial in 5 days. That was an incredible feat for all these charges and all the information and the discovery that had to be done. If we only had two trials, I bet we could do it in the same amount of time. You're probably looking 2 days for the security deposits. You're maybe looking 3 days for the tax stuff. Now, this court in Edwards is what the case respondent relies on, non-presidential opinion. All right, they noted evidence presented for each offense at separate trials would necessarily overlap with the evidence presented in the trial for the other offenses. The important thing about Edwards and the reliance on that is that the appellant wanted a separate trial for each victim, each count. We're not asking for that. We were just asking for two separate trials in this case. That was it. Additionally, Mr. Allseams was denied his right to a fair trial in this case for four main reasons. One, the prosecution sustained objections during closing arguments. Two, there was a late discovery dumped by the prosecution, which led to the defense being denied a continuance request. Three, the district court allowed a demonstrative exhibit to be shown of the report contained in the late discovery dump. And four, there was prosecutorial misconduct from the prosecutor's false statement in court. Each one of those warrants a reversal here, but in the alternative, the cumulative effect of all of them together denied him a right to a fair trial.
So the district court decided that the 14-day rule, which I think is related, as you explained it in your brief, to the objection that was sustained during the closing argument of the appellant on the appellant side, the district court decided that was a legal issue for the district court to apply and not something that should be submitted to the jury. Do you disagree with that part of the district court's? Obviously, you disagree with other things, but do you disagree with that part of the district court's analysis?
I do disagree, and I know my time is short here. A couple of things. It's a simple rule. If you rent your home out for 14 days of left, you don't have to declare the income. But also, it went towards Mr. Alsiam's understanding of the tax laws and whether he knew his tax returns were false about a material matter for those years.
It only affected, though, 2 years, right? There were only 2 years in which the income that, or the number of days that the properties were rented out then would fall under this 14-day rule, correct?
Your Honor, I see I'm out of time. May I answer your question?
You may.
Yes. Motions for acquittal were granted based on the 14-day rule for years 2017 and 2019. Thank you.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal time. Counsel for the state.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Andrew Jackala. I'm with the Washington County Attorney's Office, and I'm here on behalf of the state of Minnesota. During appellant's argument, the court inquired about this issue of a carryover from the 2013 judgment. And just to clarify in a couple points, the way that the tax laws work is if you have a operating loss from a certain year through a judgment or otherwise, you have 20 years to carry over that loss. And it's not as though you can take this $500,000 loss and claim it each year along the way, but you can break that up into pieces and say, okay, this year I've got a $50,000 gain. I'm going to apply $50,000 from that loss to this to net out a zero income. So that's the way that operates. But in order to take advantage of that exception, there's certain things that need to be done initially. So this judgment was issued in 2013. And at some point, what Mr. Alsiam did is he made a notation in his tax return that there was a judgment in 2013, and he provided the case number for that. Well, in that case, there were...
In his 2016 return, he made that notation?
He did. I'm sorry. Thank you for the correction. He referenced this case. But that case had multiple defendants. And it's certainly not clear just by citing a district court case that Mr. Alsiam would be entitled to the credit from that full $500,000 judgment. In order to take advantage of that situation, what he needs to do is go back and amend his 2013 tax return, the year from the judgment, and provide specific information about his liability on that judgment and the amount that he personally owes. He never did that. So when he tried to make this claim this deduction for 2016, there was no factual basis. He didn't amend the previous return, and the Department of Revenue said, we don't have enough information here, so what we're not going to allow this deduction. So that's how that happened.
And you cited, I think, in your brief at least, other bases for the offense of false statements in 2016.
Yeah.
Rental income, some capital gains, et cetera.
Yeah, I think the primary one was there was a... you failed to report capital gains on this broker and barter exchange. It's a 1099-B is the form that this would be on. And so what happened is he sold some securities, I believe, and had a capital gain on that sale. That was never reported. And counsel looks at that and says, well, you know, that's one mistake. Mistakes happen, right? But when the court is looking at an individual instance claimed to be a mistake, you've got to take a broader look and say, well, this isn't just one mistake. This is part of a pattern of mistakes that went on. And, you know, if we have enough mistakes that happen, it doesn't seem like a mistake. It seems like an attempt to defraud the state. And that's exactly what the district court, how the district court construed that, both in the particularly in the probable cause challenge, is said, we've got this pattern. And case law says that there's a number of things that you can look for to make a determination as to whether or not it's fraudulent or just a mistake. Knowledge of tax laws, prior mistakes, the amount of the overall loss. And, you know, Mr. Allseams at trial claimed that, you know, I'm just this individual, this construction guy, tax laws are complicated, and it's perfectly common to make mistakes. Hey, even the Department of Revenue made a mistake on their pro forma. But what's interesting about that argument is, for as complex as these tax laws may be to him, not once did he make a mistake that benefited the state to his detriment. There wasn't ever an overpayment by Mr. Allseams. It was always an underpayment, and a significant underpayment at that, because he was not reporting rental income. He was not reporting capital gains. He was overstating mortgage deductions. All of these things that compounded over the course of the 6 years that the charges were filed from, it's a clear pattern. And courts can look at that pattern and say, once is maybe a mistake, this pattern shows it wasn't a mistake.
Can you speak to the severance issue and the prejudice? Is it your view that the theft by swindle, that the evidence for the state and the theft by swindle would not include or need the renters to testify? What combines those sets of crimes into the same behavioral incident? And could you have tried it separately as suggested by your opposing counsel here?
Well, yeah, certainly. I think anytime you have multiple counts, you certainly could.
I mean, without the same witnesses,
theoretically.
In other words, without the, specifically without the renters. The renters were the key to the theft by swindle charge.
Yeah, certainly. The renters were. It depends on what level of detail the state wanted to go in. These sales taxes were parts of transactions, right? So that's how the sales taxes arise. If the state felt it necessary or compelled to do so in order to substantiate the fact that there were transactions that took place, you need to do that through either contracts or renters. So there is this connection. And what the case law advises to do is to look at commonality in a similar behavioral incident and time and geography. And those factors all weighed in favor of keeping this as a unified trial. And
speak to this prejudice, though, of a combined trial.
Yeah, and I think Judge Bradfold made a really good point on that, that I don't see how there possibly is prejudice here. And particularly because of the point that Judge Bradfold raised in the district.
Well, actually, counsel, if you don't mind, I'm not making points. I was repeating the district court's decision, right?
Correct.
So why don't you go with that?
Correct.
Okay.
Citing the district court as saying this evidence could have come in either way, through 404B, Spriegel, absence of mistake, pattern of conduct. So for appellant to say that this having separate trials would have been a way of providing him a perfectly clear trial, two perfectly clear trials, it doesn't really equate to that, because there would be some bleed over. And certainly if Mr. Allseams was committing multiple bad acts, multiple crimes related to individual transactions, I have trouble believing that the state wouldn't bring in the evidence of the other crime under a Spriegel analysis.
Wouldn't attempt to bring it in, but that doesn't necessarily mean the court would have ruled in favor of the state on the Spriegel argument.
Certainly, and that's speculative at this point. But what the district court did focus on is looked at this State v. Edwards decision that came down from this court. Granted, it is unpublished, but It can certainly be used as showing some parallels there. And
so opposing counsel made the point that in Edwards they sought to sever each count, and that was never the proposal here. So they really are two different scenarios. Do you agree with that view of Edwards?
That is a minor distinction, I suppose.
Well, is it, counsel? I mean, this was a two trials proposal, as I understood it, by the appellant.
Sure. But the ultimate policy interests that were at play in Edwards were also at play in this case.
And if you would, explain for me how the Rule 404, what 404B argument you would have made. Say we have a theft by swindle trial, which proves that the security deposits for the renters weren't returned by Mr. Alsiams. How does that evidence then, how is it offered to prove the state's case on the tax issues, on the tax accounts?
Well, again, going back to the fact that these are particular transactions. And so in order to present a full scope of what these transactions encompassed, it's legitimate in my mind to bring in the participants in the transactions in order to...
No, I understand you'd bring the renters in to prove the sales tax part, but how about the swindle itself? How would that, the rental deposit issue, how does that become relevant evidence on the tax issue?
Well, I think because the part of the swindle, not the corpus delicti, but part of this whole concept of a swindle is these renters were asked to make payments that they believed were sales taxes. So if the question on the tax side of the case is what parties understood this line item to be, I think the renters come in and they're allowed to give their impression or their understanding of what it was that they were paying for when they see this line that says ST with a rate that coincides with the Minnesota sales tax rate. And then after the fact, find out that Mr. Alsiams was pocketing that and calling it a stay fee that happens to have the same unique rate of 7.125%. So in my mind, that does speak to a central issue in the sales tax side of it, and there is carryover that militates in favor of having the trials unified. Mm-hmm. Council also addressed this 14-day rule that came up in connection with the closing arguments. And he referred to it, characterized it as a simple rule. And I suppose depending on how you look at that rule, how closely you look at it, you could say, sure, it is simple. You have 14 days that you're allowed to rent out your property. But that wasn't the question that was put in front of the district court. That's not the question that they were scratching their heads about. The issue there was whether or not that 14-day rule applied, because when Congress drafted that exception into the tax code, it specifically said that the 14-day rule applies to individuals and S corporations. Now, on these rent transactions, it wasn't an individual or an S corporation that were involved. What Mr. Alsiams did is once he got these inquiries from prospective tenants through VRBO, he referred them out and said, you know, don't go through VRBO, way too complicated. Just come and do this transaction through my company, Kia Sons. Well, Kia Sons is an LLC, limited liability company, not an individual, not an S corporation. So the question was whether or not that 14-day rule applied to a limited liability company when LLCs are not specifically mentioned in the tax code. So it's not just a simple question. And in fact, to show just how complicated it was, Judge Meslow, when he was considering this, he said, you know, This is an issue that we have never addressed. I don't know that there are even any cases out there. So what I want to do is really dig into this. I'm going to give you 2 weeks to brief it, and I want you to cover the entire United States. This is a federal law. I want to find out if there's any federal decisions out there that apply this 14-day rule to a limited liability company. So it's not just as easy as looking at it and saying 14 days, 15 days. It is far more complicated than that. And, you know, that issue came up on the morning of closing arguments. And Judge Maslow said, hey, this is a complicated issue. If it had come up during motions in limine months ago, I'd be there. I'd be able to make a decision on this. Even if it came up a week ago when motions in limine were submitted, I'd probably have time to look at it. But you're dumping this in my lap right before closing arguments. We're talking about a legal issue.
To be clear, counsel, I think the issue that was presented to the district court on closing argument had to do with whether to dismiss the 2 years that ultimately were acquitted. What is that, 2017
and 2019.
Right, 2019. So that's the issue that happened at closing argument. As far as the 14-day rule, that actually came up during testimony, right?
It was not
a surprise issue, was it, to the state?
No, it wasn't. But you're right, that did come up in the context of dismissal right before closing arguments. And what the judge said is, you know, if I dismiss this off the cuff without digging into it a little bit more, jeopardy is already attached, so you can't unring that bell and come back and bring those charges again if I made the wrong decision. And I see my time is up, so I'll thank the court for its time and attention and turn it back over to Mr. Ambrose.
Thank you. Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Robert Ambrose again on behalf of appellant.
Thank you.
Quickly on the net operating loss. Presented at trial, the Minnesota Department of Revenue did not dispute the actual loss. They just didn't allow it. Secondly, severance and where is the prejudice? It's incredibly prejudicial, and it's also not relevant. If we did hypothetically have two trials, it depends, again, what trial would go first. If we have the first trial about taxes, I don't believe it's relevant, and it's incredibly prejudicial to bring in any evidence about Mr. Allseem's failure to pay security deposits back and alleged theft by swindle charges. Third, the 14-day rule, the defendant has a...
It's not relevant. It might be relevant in the Spriegel context.
In the Spriegel context, if the court would allow such Spriegel evidence on income tax and sales tax about a bad act, potentially, of not paying security deposits back. I'm sure district courts may allow that in, certainly, but that doesn't detract from my position that it would be incredibly prejudicial towards a criminal defendant. Third, the 14-day rule. A defendant has a right to a complete defense. The fact that the district court later granted motions for acquittal on count 17 and 19 because of this issue shows we should have been able to talk about it in closing.
Can I ask this? From your brief, I mean, I just want to understand your argument. It only deals with what was objected to during closing arguments, right? I mean, there's reference to not instructing a jury, but I don't actually see that as separately briefed.
Right, because they were later granted motions for acquittal, so I think...
Your reference to, like, didn't instruct the jury in your brief, I can set that aside and just focus on what you didn't get to argue in closing arguments, right?
Correct.
Or where the defense counsel didn't get to argue. And the court said, you can talk about the testimony from the witnesses, but again, the law is a law that I apply. I'm not sure I know what it is that the defense wanted to argue relative to the 14-day rule that you couldn't.
We weren't allowed to talk about what the witnesses talked about, despite the district court saying we were going to, because right thereafter, the prosecution objected, and it was sustained.
So it's more than on pages 47 and 48 of the, what is this, respondent's brief. There was an objection. You heard three people testify. Objection, Your Honor, sustained. Can't talk about testimony from the witnesses? You can talk about testimony from the witnesses, but again, the law is what I apply. Okay, and then he said, and then defense counsel, you heard three witnesses take the stand and talk about if you rent your home, and then started talking about the law again. If you rent your home, sustain. I'm just wondering, I mean, they could testify that I rented for fewer than 14 days, it sounds like.
I'm not certain. And it became the point where, what do you want to see in front of the jury when you keep getting sustained objections during your closing argument? At some point, you just have to make a strategic decision and not keep pressing the point. My point now is we had a right to a complete defense and talk about that and talk about what three witnesses testified to, two from the Minnesota Department of Revenue, and one was the criminal defendant.
And that defense would be if you rent your home for less than 14 days, or 14 days or less, I think, right? You don't need to report that as income.
Correct.
And that although they were, you got acquittal on those charges later, that somehow it poisoned the jury.
In a way, in the larger picture is it undermined the credibility of the investigation and the prosecution and how much time they had to investigate this case, and that there were two major tax years that they didn't apply the 14-day rule to, and they didn't provide sufficient evidence to the jury during trial that he rented out 15 days or more. So a lot of the trial was focused on what was the investigation like. What did they actually prove? And then we got shut down in closing from even talking about that. And it is a simple rule, and the whole notion to make it more complex from the state is about this S-corp and individual. Now, that's not complex. During the whole trial, they said Mr. Allseams and Keeson's were the same thing. And the district court, in its order on this motion for acquittal, basically said the same thing. It wasn't that complex of an order. It was 5 pages long. The fifth page was a signature page, and there were 2 pages of conclusions of law. It was not that difficult of an issue. He deserved acquittal before the jury. I see that my time is up. Thank you.
There don't appear to be any other questions, so thank you both. Thank you for your thorough briefing. Well briefed, well done. Good arguments today. We appreciate it. It helps the court in rendering our decision. We will issue that decision within the statutory period. As a matter is submitted and under advisement. Thank you both.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Have a good day.